And we are off and running. Good afternoon, everybody. A good gray afternoon, I guess it is. Going to stay that way. Stan Turner with you here, 12:06 on this Saturday afternoon. Very happy to have your company. As always, we have endeavored to give you a program here that will, we trust, inform you and maybe entertain you along the way, although the subject matter today is somber and in some cases sorrowful, but riveting nonetheless, and we'll get to that in just a minute, because this is a momentous spot on the calendar in November, and I think a lot of you are going to want to hear what we have to say here. Just one thing on a very bright note, I had the honor and the privilege to see a very special occasion last night at that wonderful fairy castle of a building in downtown St. Paul, the Landmark Center. It used to be the Federal Courts Building. Then they called it the Old Federal Courts Building. A jewel of a place on Rice Park. You know, Rice Park surrounded by the Ordway Theater on one side, the Central Library on the other, the St. Paul Hotel on the other. Then there is that glorious, glorious Landmark Center. And there people gathered last night for a soiree in support of that building, which, this was breathtaking. In the 1970s, it came within weeks of being torn down. The great minds of the time, some of them wanted to make a parking lot out of it. Those are the kinds of buildings, George, you'll never see again. You can't
probably
build those.
Probably not. You're true.
Anybody who's been even on the outside of that building is awestruck by it. But to go inside, it's an absolute gem. This year marks its 111th birthday, and that was the occasion for the anniversary being celebrated last night. The gala last night raises money to support the building as a valuable landmark. It's aptly named, isn't it, Landmark mm-hmm. Center? And as a stage for a variety of programs for the entire community. They have weddings there. They have all kinds of receptions. Many arts organizations have their offices in that building. And way back in the day, George, back in the 20s and 30s, the likes of Elvin Creepy Carpus and members of the Ma Barker gang, the gal friend of John Dillinger, they were all tried in that building in those beautiful courtrooms upstairs. So it is a building with a history, a building that is going to survive thanks to the good citizens of this area who last night threw out a few shekels there to attend this soiree, and they were treated to a wonderful gala, good. And we had a great time. It was just a real honor to be part of it in a small way and to watch what unfolded. So thank you to everybody who organized. I liked what they call it. It was called Once Upon a Time, and we sprinkled the evening with history from and about the Landmark Center. So, good stuff. It's 12:08. Let's get on with it here. This weekend marks the 38th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The big ore boat went down in a monster storm on Lake Superior on November 10th, 1975, just a day after leaving the docks in Superior, Wisconsin. Yes, 38 years ago, almost at this hour, that ore boat left Superior. And that's a song, of course, you'll be hearing a lot of this weekend, the Gordon Lightfoot song, the tribute to the crew of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the story put to song there. This noon hour, we're going to relive that epic tragedy, and joining me in studio is Marlon Bree. Marlon is a veteran Great Lakes sailor who has written widely and expertly on the Fitzgerald sinking and many other harrowing moments on the Big Lakes. Marlon is here to explain his conclusions about why and how the big ore carrier, the Fitzgerald, went down when others caught in that howling storm made it to safety. Marlon, it is so good to have you back again, my friend. It's been a long, long time, and it just feels good to have you in that chair again.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
You are welcome. You're looking well, and how about this? We're right on the date, aren't we? This is the day, November 9th. It was in 1975, almost at this hour, as I said, maybe an hour hence from now.
No, you have it right. That's about the time that she was just getting ready to leave the Superior entryway and head out into ultimately what would be legend. She's the Titanic of the Great Lakes.
That's what we call her. She's kind of our Titanic story here in the inland sea, as we call the Great Lakes. And we're going to be hooking up two folks with this hour with Michael Schumacher. Michael has also written about the Fitzgerald disaster, and he is also going to visit with us about his new book. It's titled November's Fury, The Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913. He and others call it a hurricane. Normally, that's a term for a tropical storm. We just on the news heard about a typhoon blowing through East Asia. That storm in 13 sent dozens of big ships down. We're going to be talking with Michael about that. His book is just out, and he's on the road right now, Michael is. We're going to hook up with him by cell phone in a little bit. I think he's heading for Detroit, maybe for a book event or a book signing. But I think you two guys have met, have you not, at something called the Gales of November? That's an annual gathering up north?
Yes, up in Duluth.
Yeah. What goes on at that affair?
Oh, talk about shipwrecks. We meet with other divers and get a little bit of a Lake Superior fix.
Right, okay. Yeah. It's an addiction, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Well, you have written, as I said, widely and also expertly about the Edmund Fitzgerald and many other maritime disasters on the Great Lakes. Your book, Broken Seas, is one of several books you have authored, put together. And this Broken Seas, which is still available, and we'll talk more about that later, really gets into the heart and soul of your research and conclusions about what took the Fitz down. Just to kind of set the stage, Marlon Brie, this day 38 years ago, let's take us to Superior, Wisconsin. The Fitzgerald was fully loaded with iron ore pellets, taconite pellets, and was leaving Superior, Wisconsin, heading out onto the Big Lake. What kind of day was it?
Oh, lovely day. Late Indian summer, not like today. And there was some storms forecast to come out of the northeast, but they were supposed to bypass the lake. And so the Fitzgerald left the Superior entryway heading north on the northern trek. Mm-hmm. And about the time she got to Two Harbors, Minnesota, she picked up an escort, the Anderson, and then the two vessels headed north.
That was the other ore boat, wasn't it?
The other ore boat, a little bit larger, a little bit little bit newer, and the Anderson would follow her in their sort of little convoy.
Ah, okay.
And then they hit the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was unexpected and because of the violence of it, this is the Witches of November stuff up there. They were having 60-mile-an-hour winds. They had 15-foot seas that would later go to 100 miles an hour.
My Lord.
And one computer study said that one out of 1,000 waves would hit 42 feet. Now, that's big stuff, you know, even for a giant ore carrier, 729 feet long.
Yes. The Fitzgerald itself, was it an older boat? Had it been around, knocking around for a long time? What kind of shape was she in?
The Fitzgerald was the biggest boat of its kind when she rolled off the waterways in the 1950s. And so by the time of this event, she'd be a fairly new boat. Ore boats are usually good for 50 years or more.
Mm.
And you can see one boat, the Irwin, that was built in 1938 in the Duluth Harbor. So they can stand up so long as they can haul their goods economically. The boats themselves don't wear out.
No, no. And what about her skipper, Ernest McSorley? This was no novice in the wheelhouse.
He was a tough guy known as a heavy weather sailor. This is a guy that would plow through any kind of seas and keep his schedule. He was a guy that came on as a deck boy and moved up to skipper. No nonsense, buff. And this was his last voyage.
Really?
Yeah, he was going to retire.
So there were some ominous storm warnings, but nothing to predict what actually befell. What happens on the Great Lakes in November? We call them the witches. Do the lakes, in fact, make their own weather in a way?
In many ways, they do. The weather comes down from the north, the Canadian and weather, and then from the south comes up the Gulf. Cool weather, and they combine, and terrible storms come up. And because it's fresh water, they move very quickly and very heartily. It's totally different on Lake Superior than it is in the ocean. And many an ocean skipper had a big surprise coming out into Superior.
Wow. If an ocean skipper thought, this will be a piece of cake navigating and sailing on the Great Lakes, he was in for a rude shock.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah, they're no piece of cake at all. Well, right now, joining us, as we said before, joining us is Michael Schumacher. Michael has, of course, as we say, also written about the Fitzgerald disaster. We'll talk about his book. And he's also visiting with us today about his new book. It's titled November's Fury, The Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913. Michael Schumacher, thank you for joining us. I guess you're on the road today, right?
I'm sitting in a parking lot in Kalamazoo as we speak.
Kalamazoo.
Oh, wait a minute. It's Battle Creek.
All right. Well, Michael, you're coming through loudly and clearly, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, good.
And I'm glad you pulled over.
My
and
pleasure.
You're safe and sound there off the highway, so you can talk with us. Marlon Bree is with us, and I believe you two have met up before, I think at the Gales of November event in Duluth. Do you recall that?
Yes, a few years back, yes.
Okay, very good. So you guys share the same passion, the same interest, and have written widely on this. I want to ask you, Marlon and I have been talking about the Fitzgerald disaster, and we'll circle back to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But with respect to your new book, I wanted to ask you right out of the chute here. You call it November's Fury, The Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913. Now, normally, that moniker, that title, that word is used for tropical storms along with typhoon. We talk about hurricanes and typhoons being tropical storms. How does this figure in a Great Lakes, an inland storm?
Well, it's interesting because there, in those days, even in 1913, they had a hurricane flag which they could use to warn boats, you know, out on the Great Lakes of a gale, let's say, of that force. They rarely, if ever, used it. They did not use it in this case. But they do have requirements for something to be a hurricane, whether it's tropical or otherwise. And in this case, it met all the requirements for wind velocity, sustained over a period of time, and such. So it technically was a hurricane, but they don't like to use that term, as you pointed out.
Okay. You know, just 8 years, as you well know, 8 years before, there was another monster storm on the Great Lakes, especially on Lake Superior, that one in 1905. Did that qualify as a hurricane, the same force winds, that sort of thing?
Not really. I mean, again, this sometimes it's a matter of who you're talking to. You know, the sailors would probably tell you, you bet it was a hurricane. That Metapa storm was unbelievable.
Yes, it was.
For a period of time, for example, Lake Huron registered unbelievable wind velocities for 16 straight hours, you know, where they were talking about winds that were exceeding 50 miles an hour.
This is the 19th.
Now, what does that mean?
Right.
If you're on Lake Huron, which took the brunt of this storm, Superior was very, very bad. Michigan was very, very bad. Huron was a nightmare. And in Michigan and Huron's case, if the winds are coming out of the north or the northeast or the northwest, it lets the seas build up. And when you get down to the bottom of Lake Michigan or the bottom of Lake Huron, you are talking about some monstrous waves. And the eight boats that sank on Lake Huron were all at the bottom of the lake. Mm. You know, where the waves had built up to an immense, you know, you're talking about the height of 2- and 3-story buildings here.
My Lord.
And rogue waves going even higher than that.
Yeah.
One of the captains out on Lake Superior claimed that he was hit by a 70-foot wave. That's real big on the Great Lakes.
Yes.
You know, in the oceans, you get these big swells that can exceed that, but not in the Great Lakes as a general rule.
Mm-hmm.
The waves come so quickly together. I mean, they're spaced much closer than you're going to find on the ocean. It makes the Great Lakes deadlier than the ocean if you're caught in a storm.
All right. Michael Schumacher. Michael's with us from Kalamazoo right now. He's on the road. He's actually pulled off the road. He's the author of a new book on the deadly, deadly storm across the Great Lakes. And right now, this weekend, as Michael, you said, it was a 4-day blow from November 7th until November 10th, 1913. So exactly 100 years ago right now. And a dozen big ships went to the bottom. Many others were grounded or smashed up on the beaches. We're going to be talking about this. Michael, stay with us. We're going to take a break here. And I want you to talk with Marlon Bree, too, who is sitting right beside me.
Oh, that'd be good.
Yeah, and after the break, here, we're going to circle back to the Edmund Fitzgerald disaster, then we'll work our way up to the 1913, back to the 1913 storm. So, folks, stay with us. We have Marlon Brie here, Michael Schumacher. Disaster on the Great Lakes here is the subject today on this, the 38th anniversary of the weekend of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald and the 100th anniversary of that monster storm in 1913 on the Great Lakes. We'll be right back.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
Did you know we had fingerprints before we were even born?
We did?
Yep, when we were only 9 weeks old.
My mom says our hearts were beating too.
Well, my mom says I could suck my thumb and smile before I was even born.
You still do. You don't have to tell.
Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski, and I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America, the Billboard People. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of information and alternatives, including adoption, or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please call 1-800-366-7773 or visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org. Pro-Life Across America, non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
And we are back. We are back here, Stan Turner, with you, 12:23 on this Saturday afternoon. We're at 45 degrees. We're about at our predicted high for today. Breezy conditions across the metro today. Winds gusting at times to 30 miles per hour. Tonight, throw on an extra blanket, a low of 28. Winds will stay up there. They'll be blustery overnight. Tomorrow, how's that looking? Well, it's going to be clouding up, high near 40. And Veterans Day on Monday, sunny skies move in. They'll prevail in a high only of 27 degrees on Veterans Day, Monday. Back here now, we are talking about a momentous time on the calendar here. 38 years ago this weekend, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the big ore carrier, which left the Superior docks, Superior, Wisconsin docks, almost at this very moment, on this day, November 9th in 1975, and heading, as the cliche goes, with a date with fate. It went to the bottom the next day with the loss of all hands, including the captain. Then, 100 years ago, on this very time, a four-day storm, a monster storm, blew across the Great Lakes. And that is the subject of a new book by Michael Schumacher, also with us today, November's Fury, the Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913. Of course, we have our friend Marlon Brie with us in studio here today. And Marlon has written widely on the Fitzgerald and other disasters, as has Michael Schumacher. So, Michael Schumacher, Marlon is here. And, of course, the number one question always, Michael, is, what brought the Fitzgerald down? What caused her to sink during that huge storm that came across, blew up across the Lake Superior? She went down ultimately on the east in the eastern waters of Lake Superior on November 10th, 1975. You're right in saying, and I've read some of your previous interviews, that we'll never know for sure, of course, what brought her down. But what is your theory in capsule form? What sank the Edmund Fitzgerald, Michael Schumacher?
Well, my theory is kind of a combination of some of the others. I believe that Bernie Cooper, who was following the Fitzgerald, was correct in thinking that it hit bottom in a shallow area near Michipicoten and Caribou Islands. I believe that that happened. I believe that it probably ruptured a number of hull plates, but not enough to sink it right away. It was carrying on, and Captain McSorley of the Fitzgerald reported a list almost immediately after they went through that area. He said he's taking on water, he's got his pumps going. Okay, so you have that. The water is coming in, and he's pumping it out from some of these ruptured hull plates. Also, having talked to two of the members of the Marine Board of Investigation who believe that it flooded topside through the hatches and took in water, and they actually did experiments with life-size hatches, complete just like the Fitzgerald, and it showed that it could take in water. Significant enough to sink the boat. I believe, in other words, that it took in water both topside and mm-hmm. below the waterline.
All right.
And it was sinking, you know, slowly in respect that it did almost make it all the way down to its to Whitefish Point.
Michael,
but
you mentioned...
It wasn't enough.
Before you go out, you mentioned Bernie Cooper. Was he the skipper of the following freighter, the ore boat? The Arthur
yes,
Anderson.
Yes, he was of the Arthur Anderson. Oh,
okay,
yes.
Let's turn now to Marlon Brie. We've heard, and thank you very much, Michael, for giving us your uh-huh. view of what brought the big boat, the Fitzgerald, down. Marlon Brie, what about you?
I've talked with Captain Cooper about that. In fact, I talked with the last two people who were in direct contact with the Fitzgerald during those fatal hours, and Cooper was in the opinion, and he stated so in his report. That the Fitzgerald was closer than the 6-fathom shoal than he'd care to be. But what we're having here is a little difference of opinion, Michael, because I think that it wasn't the hatches, as you state in your book, that sank the Fitzgerald, but it was a collision with 6-fathom shoal, because before he went into that area, he was chatting with the Anderson, but within minutes after passing through that area, he had three significant happenings. One is a list, second, fence rail down, and third, mm-hmm. Broken ballast vents. Mm-hmm. And the only way that that boat could have a list was if she bottomed out on one of her ballast tanks,
right.
And that is on the starboard side. So it's my feeling that it was the flooding of the ballast tanks that began to take her down. And the proof of the ballast tank was that the fence rail down was evidence of hogging, and that the ballast vents was hydraulic pressure, because this is something that they look for when they load up those boats. So I think that it was probably a grounding of the starboard ballast tanks, mm-hmm. probably right after, in the area of hatch covers 1 and 2.
In other words, the Fitzgerald grounded out. She bottomed out. She
yes.
hit an uncharted shallow reef.
Yes, an okay. uncharted
reef. And that started the sequence of events. Michael, what's yes. your response to that?
I agree. That's, okay. Maybe I didn't make myself clear.
No, you did.
Before,
you did.
I believe that the major event was the grounding.
Right. Right.
I believe that what happened in talking to a number of people going out to Washington D.C. and looking at the testimony at the hearings, the Coast Guard hearings, that this boat. And one of the people that I talked to said McSorley was talking about how high the waves were. They were monster waves. He said he wouldn't have known. He'd never ridden that low in the water before. The boat was sinking almost from the moment it went past that those shoals. I don't doubt for 1 second that it hit bottom.
Okay.
When I said that about coming topside, I'm just saying that aided in the sinking. The main event was definitely, in my opinion, mm-hmm. the grounding. No question in my mind.
That's right, and
so I don't think there's really much disagreement.
No,
here.
I don't think so. You're pretty much on the same page.
I'm giving out the hatch covers because they showed the Fitzgerald, and when you look at the pictures of the Fitzgerald underwater where she is today, when you look at the hatch clamps on that, you know, hatch cover clamps, like every fourth one is unbelievably destroyed. The other three are pristine, like they're brand new. Now, that gives you an indication that it was not completely battened down. the Fitz was, when it left port, people observed people still battening down the hatches. And what probably happened, and again, this is all speculation, is that they hit the storm earlier than they anticipated. They had the hatches, you know, clamped down like they would under normal circumstances, but with a storm of that magnitude, they weren't all battened down, and as a result, you had a sort of a weird bowling effect that happened between the clamps that were clamped down. And it would let water in other words, a significant amount, but not enough to sink the boat. And when you add that water that's coming in to the water that's really coming in from the grounding, that boat really didn't have much chance. I think that's essentially my answer to it, is that I think when I study shipwrecks, it always seems that it's several things that lead to a fatality. It's never like one thing. Bad everything going on in some cases. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense until you really look at it. I don't know, you know. I mean, anybody's theory is good. I'm sure in fact, I'm not just saying this either. Well, people actually talk about, oh, I went into the Bermuda Triangle of the Great Lakes.
Yeah, right.
Well, okay then.
All right, Michael. Michael.
You know, I mean, what are you supposed to say?
Let me jump in here. I just want to say, for people just tuning in, we're talking about the disaster, the wreck, the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the big ore carrier that went to the bottom of Eastern Lake Superior this weekend, 38 years ago. With us, Marlon Bree in the studio here, who has written widely and expertly about it. Also with Michael Schumacher, also an author of a book on the Fitzgerald, and a new book. We'll get to that in just a little bit later in the hour. But Marlon Bree, we just heard Michael Schumacher again here. The hatches, we don't want to turn this into a lecture on maritime disasters, but basically, I think you both are agreed that that the ship bottomed out.
Yep, and after that, it was a cascading
series
of events, including a giant wave that probably overran the Fitzgerald and piled up behind the pilot house and then sent her submarining to the bottom, at which point the hatches did implode because of the underwater pressure.
Michael and Marlon, was there any chance at all for the crew of the Fitzgerald to try to get off? It was a raging storm, as you've all both said, huge, monstrous waves. There probably was not a chance, was there, to get into a life raft or a lifeboat of any kind?
I talked with Captain Cooper about that, and I said, well,
he was skipper of the following ore boat.
Right? I said, why didn't you pull up, you know, alongside, Fitzgerald? He said, there's no way that in those conditions and in those waves with those boats bouncing around that you could affect a rescue.
Any kind.
They couldn't transfer. Yeah. And also, in those waves and in this cold weather, there's no way that the crews would want to go to the lifeboats or anything else. He said, in fact, the only time that a crew will leave a Great Lakes boat is when they have to step up.
Step up. That's it. Okay.
That's when the boat is down and they have to step up to get to someplace else.
Gentlemen, do you think there was any evidence whatsoever in Captain McSorley's words to indicate that maybe some of the crew on the Fitz had thoughts about getting off?
Sure. We heard a portion of his radio transcript, and this was... I heard it myself, rebroadcast, and it's also in the official record. And he said, don't let those men get out on deck. He turned to his first mate and said, don't let them get... And I talked with a Great Lakes skipper, a guy I used to rent a boathouse from and where I stayed for many years, converted boathouse out on Lake Superior. And he said, oh, they're trying to get off. They were that scared. That's what a Great Lakes captain said. That's why they were out on deck.
I'm not sure that's true, though, Marlon.
Well, it's just his opinion, of course.
Think about this.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Michael.
If you've seen the wreckage, that first hatch right behind the pilot house, the first one, is unbelievably destroyed.
Yeah, I've seen the videotapes, Michael, yes.
You may be right. I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm saying there could be another explanation. One of the things that people, the sailors, did, if they lost a hatch cover, and it's very possible that the Fitzgerald lost a hatch cover in this. And men were thinking of going out and putting tarp down to keep the waves out of the hatches, from flooding the hatches. And they may have been considering that, and he said, don't let those men out there.
Yeah, he was looking at
them. They weren't trying to escape.
Well, he was looking at the men in the aft section. That'd be about 600 feet behind him. Mm-hmm. And the first hatch would be directly below him. Mm-hmm. And there would be other people that could do something with that. And the only way that they can do anything about those hatches, which are 11 feet deep and some 46 feet wide and weigh 12,000 pounds, is by using that giant crane that they have to expressly pick them up or put them down. So if they go, and I doubt that they went on the surface, that would be the only thing that they could use to affect a change.
Gentlemen, one thing is for sure, 29 men who were on board the Fitzgerald went to their deaths on November the 10th. And that'll be 38 years ago. And we do, and Michael, I know you and Marlon want us to mention here in the course of this discussion that there will be a very special, a very solemn ceremony, as every year happens on November the 10th at Split Rock Lighthouse, just north of Two Harbors on the northern shore of Lake Superior, Minnesota there. And they'll be showing there at the Split Rock Lighthouse tomorrow a film about the Fitzgerald. It'll be shown in the Visitor Center, a beautiful place there. It'll be shown continuously throughout the afternoon tomorrow. The lighthouse in the Fog Signal Building will be open tomorrow from noon to 6 p.m. This again at Split Rock Lighthouse Historical Site. The lighthouse will close temporarily tomorrow at 4:30 in the afternoon while the names of the 29 lost crew members are read to the tolling of a ship's bell. And following the ceremony, the beacon in the lighthouse will be lit and the tower once again open for visitors to tour. And I just want to put this out. If you want more information, if you happen to be heading that way or want to head that way for this ceremony, Split Rock at mnhs.org. The website again, to give you more information, Split Rock, all one word, at mnhs, as in Minnesota Historical Society, .org. Phone number 218-226-6372. So there you have the information. A very special, very solemn ceremony. In fact, they're going to ring the bell 30 times. The extra ringing is for all mariners, all seagoing people who have died on the Great Lakes over the centuries. So it's the Fitzgerald crew of 29 plus one more representing all the others. So, Michael, have you ever been to that ceremony? You've been up there for that?
No, I haven't. Actually, I'm going to be in Detroit tomorrow for the one that they're doing at the Dawson Museum on Belle Isle, which has one of the Fitzgerald anchors, and it has the pilot house of the William Clay Ford, which is one of the boats that went out looking for the Fitzgerald. The same thing, incidentally. Tolling of the bells 30 times and a laying of the wreath on the water. Very solemn ceremony.
Yes.
I've been to them, but not the one up there at Split Rock.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Lee Radzik, the director of Split Rock, just last weekend, and it sounded like he's got something really special planned there. And they always have a very special one, of course, at the museum at Whitefish Point. This is a big event for a lot of people. It wasn't just limited to one area. It affected a lot of people, the Great Lakes. For some reason, it wasn't just the Gordon Lightfoot song, but it was the fact that it was modern, the fact that it was so unpredictable. This was a huge, extremely well-put-together vessel that sank. So when they do these ceremonies, they do them all over the lakes, and they're all very, very moving, at least the ones that I've attended.
Yes, indeed. And Marlon Bree, have you attended any? Have you been up there?
Been up to the lighthouse several times in the White House, on the Whitefish Point, where the bell is still.
Yes.
And I like Michael's point about how much the sinking of the vessel affected so many people on the Great Lakes, and especially Lake Superior. I remember when I was making a voyage out of the Apostle Islands down into the Superior entryway, and one foggy night I was having a beer with a tugboat captain, and I heard it was foggy out there, and this was near the Superior entryway. In fact, it's the old light Coast Guard house. Mm-hmm. And I heard three whistles, and I said, "What's that?" And I heard the thumping, and suddenly, out of the fog, a big wall of steel went right by, and he said, that's an oar boat going out onto the Great Lakes.
Ghostly.
Yes. And he said, that's the same entry that the Fitzgerald used when she left on her fateful day.
That put a chill up your spine.
Yeah, and we started talking about the tugboat captain and myself about the changes of the things that have happened pertaining to the Fitzgerald. A lot of feeling. There's an interest in there that's runs very deep because mariners simply have to know what happened.
Yes.
Because if you don't know, you have the feeling it might happen to you. And these are sort of like the tales you tell around the campfire, what's out there in the dark woods.
Absolutely. Well, good points made by both Michael and Marlon here. And we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. And, Michael, we're going to be focusing, if you can stay with us, focusing on your new book, taking us back 100 years this weekend, this time, November's Fury, the deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913. We'll be right back.
I'm Corey Bittner, owner of Leo's Grill and Malt Shop in Stillwater. My dad, Leo, was a veteran of World War II. So on Veterans Day, we invite all veterans for a free meal.
The anticipation, it's killing me.
Enjoy sizzling burgers, hand-scooped malts, and more. Thank you. Veterans and active duty personnel get a free meal on Veterans Day, November 11th, at Leo's Grill and Malt Shop, Main and Chestnut in downtown Stillwater.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
I'm Stan Turner with exciting news for book lovers. Downtown Stillwater has just completed its new pedestrian walkway next to Valley Bookseller. Park right next to the store, then enjoy your new books out on the deck or on Stillwater's new patio overlooking the St. Croix. Valley Bookseller is indeed the Twin Cities' most beautiful bookstore. Great books, great people, great view. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com. We are back. Stan Turner with you here. Thank you so much for your company. We are we're going back in history here, and it's history we need to revisit because it really has become part of our collective memories here, especially the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. That oar boat, the big boat, went down on this weekend 38 years ago. The gales of November. Yes, they're deadly. Marlon Bree is with us. Marlon has written widely and, as we always say, expertly about, of course, the Fitzgerald and other happenings, many of them not happy happenings on the Great Lakes. His book, Broken Seas, S-E-A-S, Marlon Bree, B-R-E-E. You can find his books, well, at Valley Bookseller. They can help you get one, Amazon.com, too. And speaking of books, our other guest, Michael Schumacher, and let me give you the spelling, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H-E-R. Good German name, good Deutsch name there, Michael. Your new book published by...
Just like the race car driver, I just don't have his money.
Maybe with this book you will. Your new book published by University of Minnesota Press is called November's Fury, the Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913. That was a big blow that lasted 4 days, November 7th through November 10th, 1913. So this weekend, we're spot in the middle of that anniversary here, 100 years ago. Michael, your book, I love the way you open it. It's chilling. Marlon just told us about a ghostly ship, an oar boat going through the fog. You open with a sailor's premonition. He was supposed to sail out on the Great Lakes in what turned out to be that hurricane of 1913, and he decided not to go. Just can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it's funny because I've heard of this happening elsewhere where the sailors will just get a premonition. Something's not right. They don't want to be on that boat. There was another case where a guy got off of a boat that sank and went on a different one. But it wasn't so much a premonition as he was just tired of the boat he was on. But he just suddenly just decided to change, you know, change boats.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, the guy who got off, had a, he just felt uneasy about it. And he had worked for a long time. He was, you know, in the engine room, and he was an assistant engineer, and he was hoping to get his own boat someday as a chief engineer. And this, you know, laid waste to that idea, because you just don't jump off of a boat like this without really a good reason. And what was ironic about it, and it was really, really sad, was his closest friends on the boat, one of whom he talked to right before he left, when he was leaving the gangway to leave the boat,
mm-hmm.
He ended up identifying when they found, you know, bodies were washing up on shore, and he found this guy. They asked the guy who jumped off board if he would come by and help identify bodies, and it was very, very sad because he was a close friend and he knew him well, and so, you know, his premonition turned true. Turned
yes.
out to be true.
Yes, yes. Now, let's give the big picture here. By the time this four-day monster storm, this hurricane on the Great Lakes was over in 1913 in November, about, what, a dozen boats had gone to the, big ships had gone to the bottom. More than 30 others
yes.
were grounded on the rocks, busted up on the rocks. And how many men lost? Over 200.
Over 250. You never know because they didn't keep good records back then, crew lists. But they know that about 250 minimum went down. I've seen, I've seen reports that thought it was even closer to 300. That
right.
sounds a little exaggerated to me, but it doesn't matter. It's a lot. This was by far the worst storm to hit the lakes in recorded history, and it was by far the most destructive.
Yeah, and you know, Michael, this is Marlin here.
Michael, here's Marlin.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's amazing that they're still finding some of the wrecks from that storm, including
isn't that something?
Including the Henry B. Smith. As a
yeah.
matter of fact, when I heard about that, I'd been out with the divers, Jerry Eliason and Craig Smith,
sure.
on some of their expeditions, you know. And they were the ones that located it, and I thought it was 30
yep.
miles out on its Superior, and that's what the report said. But when I brought up the satellite map with the coordinates, I found that it was just off a marina that I had been on when I was along the shipwreck coast in a 35-foot catamaran.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that I probably sailed right over the bones of that ship. That's just was discovered
did.
This
yeah.
May. She didn't get very far. And it was just an amazing feeling to look at that satellite map and to realize what I had done and to realize that only today they're still finding some of those wrecks.
It's amazing. Michael?
Those guys were at the Gales of November conference last weekend and did a PowerPoint presentation of all of this. And it's very eerie.
Michael,
you see the boat after 100 years.
No kidding. Michael Schumacher, what about weather? And what were the weather forecasts calling for on, say, November 6th or even 7th, the first day of the storm?
They thought it was going to be, you know, kind of rough, the weather, but nothing that any boat couldn't handle. It's a couple things that we really need to mention here. First of all, it's important to remember that most boats stayed in during that storm. You know, most of the crafts either stayed in at the port or they dropped an anchor in the lee of the storm and waited it out. But some didn't. Some boats went out before the real storms were forecast. They thought it would be windy, but they didn't have any notion that it was going to be this bad. And part of the problem here was it wasn't just one storm. There was one front, I should say, well, just one front. There was a front, what we call a clipper, moving right along the Canadian-U.S. border, and that dipped down into Minnesota and set off all the action on Lakes Superior and Michigan. And it was a bad one. The front intensified as it was dropping down, and it wreaked all kinds of havoc on the water. Meanwhile, coming up from Georgia was another very strong front that moved up the eastern seaboard and then abruptly turned west and focused over the Ohio Valley, and it met up with this clipper, forming one monster system. And then there was a smaller system from the south that had come up. It wasn't anywhere near as significant as the other two. So it was a joining of like three different fronts that set off the absolute maelstrom that occurred on Lake Huron. So it was a number of things. You know, they didn't have any way of knowing it was going to be this bad. And second part of the problem was, today we think of a lot of things that we used to forecast weather. Back then it was pretty rudimentary. And, you know, they'd hang a flag out and say the wind is coming from the northwest, and a half hour later it's blowing really hard from the north or from the northeast. They shifted very unpredictably and with really tragic results.
Well, gentlemen, I want to ask you something about sailing the Great Lakes, especially in November. Back then especially, of course, these shipping companies, the time was money, and they needed to get their loads down to, from wherever the start of the voyage was to down to the factories in the east. And so there was great economic pressure on the captains of the ships, and they would sometimes maybe sail against their own better judgment late in November at great risk.
Absolutely. You know, I've talked with some captains, and they say, well, you know, the captain is in charge of the boat, and he decides whether to go out. However, the shipping dispatching department will put incredible pressure on the captain, say, well, Captain, other boats are going out. How about you? And, you know, if you sit in port when everybody else is going out, you're not going to be captain very long.
All right. Michael, what about
Jimmy,
that?
Owen, the guy on the boat, Henry B. Smith, that you mentioned, Marlon, according to the story, he was told point blank, he'd had some incidents earlier in the year where he'd come in late. And they told him, you either sail or look for employment elsewhere. He did not want to sail. The weather was so miserable at the dock that they had to hammer the iron ore out of the chutes. They were freezing in the chutes and on railroad cars. They literally were lighting fires under the railroad cars to loosen his stuff. It was horrible.
Oh, Lord.
And he didn't want to go out.
And he didn't get very far, did he?
No, he didn't. I mean, you've probably seen the stuff, Marlon, where they talked to captains of other boats that were actually in that port. And they thought he was crazy going out.
Right, right.
He waited till there was a little lull in the storm. You know, there was the blizzard conditions. It was snowing like crazy. Mm. And he waited till there was a little bit of a lull, and then took off. And these other guys are going, what, is he crazy? And not insignificantly, his crew was battening down the hatches when they left port. That's something that you just don't do. You're either prepared or you're not. He was in a hurry. He'd been given a real hard time about making it in. And one of the last things he did was he went to the telegraph office and sent a message to his boss saying, we're on the way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Under just a wee bit of pressure.
And now here it is.
Yeah.
You find his boat. It's cracked in two pieces, sitting at the bottom of the lake, and he probably wouldn't have gone out if he hadn't been pushed.
Pushed, indeed. So many, obviously, disastrous, tragic things happened. Some very strange things happened, too. In the wake of the 1913 hurricane storm you write about on the Great Lakes, Michael, and one of them has to do with a tugboat that sank in 1906, so 7 years before this storm. Long lost. Nobody knew where it was until this storm blew through. We're talking here about the tugboat Searchlight. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it was a very strange story to begin with, because the tugboat disappeared in broad daylight under ideal sailing conditions. There was a guy in the lighthouse that was watching it, and he turned away for a couple minutes. He looked back, and it was gone. Nobody knew what happened to it. Nobody knew why it sank. They don't to this day. But it disappeared. And, of course, they sent out search boats and everything else. Not a sign of anything. Of a wreck, not any bodies, nothing. And then all of a sudden, all these years later, this big storm boils up the water and regurgitates some wreckage and one of the bodies. Nobody could believe that this happened, but it did, and it's one of those great mysteries. No
All
one
right.
to this day knows
Have we
why
lost
that
Michael Schumacher?
That tugboat sank.
Oh, we're there. Okay. All right. All right, what a strange, strange thing. It's almost like that oarboat through the fog there, the ghost
yes,
ship, huh?
Yes,
amazing,
yes.
Amazing.
Exactly.
Yes, yes. What else about the storm? This is a huge storm, a four-day event in this time of year in 1913. Michael, tell us a bit more. What are some more of the major points you want to make here in the book? And it's really a great
read.
Well,
the thing that always comes out of these things, it's significant also, I should add, that of all the boats that went down, the dozen boats that went down, not a single soul survived. This was lost with all hands in every case. They did find, not just evidence, they didn't speculate because they found bodies. There was strong evidence because a couple of lifeboats came ashore, including one with a captain and two other people in it. They had died of hypothermia, but in other words, there was evidence that some people at least tried to abandon ship in the middle of this storm, where they thought they were going to go or how, because they didn't have much chance, mm-hmm. a choice rather.
Right, right.
They just got off because they knew they weren't going to last, in this.
Yeah, certainly.
One of the captains saw, this I thought was very eerie, one of the captains in the Crawford, that boat, watched another boat, the Argus, he said, crack like an egg. Right on the surface, it split and sank. How horrifying would that be?
That's about the...
If you're in the distance and you're watching that happen.
It's about as bad as it gets. Well, Michael Schumacher and Marlon Brie, let's see now, we've had books on the 1905 monster storm mm-hmm. on the Great Lakes, especially Lake Superior. That was done by Kurt Brown about 1908,
mm-hmm.
excuse me, about 8 years ago he wrote the book about So Terrible a Storm.
Excellent book, too.
And so is yours. Now we have the 1913 storm by Michael Schumacher on the line, Schumacher with us on the line here. Gentlemen, are there any more big storms we can have books written about? Because these are fascinating. What do you think? Are we running out of big storms?
Well, one of the things you learn when you sail Superior is that it's going to happen again.
Yes.
So there'll be things that we'll be able to report on in the future.
Yeah, okay. All right, gentlemen. Well, George, are we just down to the last 30 seconds, are we? Is that it? Okay, that would be it. Michael Schumacher, thank you so much for pulling over and being with us today. Thanks for a great book, too.
It was my pleasure, indeed. It was great talking to you, Marlon.
Nice talking to you.
Marlon Brie, nice to see you. You come back soon, my friend, will
you? Thank you.
Okay, Marlon Brie, author of Broken Seas and other great books. Thank you, everybody. Have a great weekend.